This is the London FinTech Podcast, brought to you by your host, Mike Ballaman, bridging the worlds of suits and t-shirts, of finance and technology, bringing you insights, stories, and inspiration from the golden age of opportunity and innovation happening in London right now.
Hi, this is Mike Ballaman, and this is London FinTech Podcast, episode 136, brought to you in association with Smart Pension. And I'm delighted to be joined today by Evgeny Likoded, CEO of ClauseMatch, for our first sortie into the world of RegTech. Where is it now? Where is it going? How will it look in 5 years' time? The most accurate statement ever made about the world of compliance in modern FS and the rest of the economy was made by Emperor Palpatine: the bureaucrats have taken over. As someone who started work well before all this state Stalinism, it seems completely mad to me. Whether it is mad or not isn't the point, however. If you're in FS or fintech, whether you like it or not, you have to deal with a never-ending tsunami of rules, 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 and yet more rules. Thus, if you want to survive, let alone thrive and get ahead of the game, you need to process all this information, requirements, production, efficiently. This is where ClauseMatch come in, as we shall hear later. To give you some feel for the magnitude of this madness, I'm sure most of you know it, but some of you may not, EU's MiFID II alone is 1,700,000 paragraphs long, for God's sake. In that respect, the cross-sectoral, horizontal GDPR at a mere 55,000 words is a positively light read, albeit one that is 20,000 words longer than Shakespeare's Hamlet. Medici Research produced a chart a little while ago about the number of global regulatory publications, changes and announcements in FS between 2008 to 2016. In 2008, there were a staggering 8,704. In 2016, it was an astonishing 52,506. Imagine the difficulty and cost of merely processing all of these, let alone implementing changes in your organisation, which is, of course, where RegTech comes in. Nor is it just the EU's state technocratic centralism and global banking regulation that is at fault. In his 2012 Reith lectures, Niall Ferguson quoted the US Small Business Administration report as having calculated the cost of regulation across all sectors in the US to US small businesses at an astonishing $1.7 trillion. Anyway, those of you surfing the tsunami know what it feels like. The rest of us can be grateful that we have other roles. Although, of course, the more folk are busy pushing paper for the bureaucrats, the more the rest of us have to make yet more profit to pay for them all. How can RegTech help in these circumstances? Is it a pinprick or can it make a big difference? Plenty to talk about, so let's get on with the show. Hi, Evgeny. Thanks for joining me today.
Hello, Mike.
So you were saying that back in the day that you were in St. Petersburg, which is a very nice place. It's a bit cold in the winter.
Yes, well, it can get to up to minus 25. So very cold winters. But yeah, I was born in St. Petersburg. I went to school there. And about 19 years ago, I moved to the UK.
I only went once to St. Petersburg, which I really liked. It's a very beautiful place. And I think that must have been quite late because there were icebergs in the Neva. But originally, it was built on all sort of marshy ground. So does it get sort of mosquito-y in the summer or really hot or anything like that?
It does get mosquito-y, yeah. Back then, it was just marshland. And about 300 years ago, Peter the Great, he decided to open a window into Europe. So that's what St. Petersburg is called, a window to Europe. So there would be a port with access to the Baltic Sea and then to all of the Eastern European countries.
And the architecture is very, very beautiful and also very kind of European, really.
Yeah, so this was Peter the Great's baby, actually. He brought in all of the European architects to build it. He actually went to Netherlands as a tsar, undercover for a month, to understand what shipbuilding was all about.
Oh, yes, I'd forgotten that story, actually. So in terms of St. Petersburg, before we sort of move on to this country, what kind of things about St. Petersburg or life in St. Petersburg do you miss today? What does it have that sort of London doesn't have? I mean, people are always saying how wonderful London is, and of course, you know, there's a lot going on and has lots of advantages and all that kind of stuff. But what do you miss about St. Petersburg? Or is it just miss being young because you were young then and didn't have to work? Your parents worked instead.
Yeah, exactly. Well, it's not just that. St. Petersburg is a really beautiful city. When you get there, it's got canals, it's got beautiful architecture. It's very cultural as well. And it's got that feel of a smaller city, even though it's a large city.
What's the population?
It's around 5 million.
All right, so it's quite reasonable size.
And I think a lot of people probably miss out on the fact that it's a very developed city. Because when you think of Russia, when you think of St. Petersburg, you don't realize how developed that country is, especially in St. Petersburg and Moscow.
Yes, as listeners will know, I've been stuck in a rabbit hole finishing my book. And finally, the draft goes to the editors next week, thank God. I've been pregnant for 2 years. And I was thinking about an epilogue which might be a little bit controversial in terms of the cultural impact on boards and companies and all that kind of stuff, which is quite significant. So actually, coming back to regulation, as we all know, there was no regulation in businesses. There were no kind of independent non-executive directors or anything like that after the Second World War. And in the 50s and 60s, in the US and UK, there were next to no corporate crashes, simply because managing directors and directors didn't try and sort of steal as much money as they can and blow up their companies and all that kind of stuff, because they had a great consideration for society as a whole. If you've been through the Second World War, and thank goodness Russia did join in because they did a lot of the brunt of it, you have a feeling for the whole society. Now, of course, that changed with Thatcher Reaganism, and it became sort of Gordon Gekko's greed is good, fill your boots. And, you know, the idea was everyone wants to maximise how much money they might make. And then, of course, the reaction to that has been this whole world of regulation. So culture really matters. But anyway, so I was just considering the cultural point at the large, and of course with all this sort of intersectionality and PC and all this kind of stuff, the claim is that actually it sort of levels the playing field, but it doesn't do that at all. And I was thinking, just walking around Canary Wharf actually, that one of the things that just pisses me off is how demonised Russia is. I find it outrageous. It really just annoys me actually. I mean, maybe in part because I had a Russian girlfriend for a few years, so I've been over there and I've seen it from the outside. But yes, there is a kind of treatment of Russia as if it's a kind of second world, if not quite the third world. But this is nonsense. I mean, Russian people that I've met are by and large very intelligent and very cultured, you know. And on this point, you're based in Canary Wharf, but also you've got a tech office in St. Petersburg.
Yes, we do. It's a very talented tech office. We've got people who worked for Apple before, for Deutsche Bank, for other banks as well. We managed to build an extremely talented tech team. For example, our data science guys, one of them worked at Apple on their most recent release of the App Store.
Yes, absolutely. I suspect that there would be cultural problems if you were just British and trying to set up a tech team in St. Petersburg or Moscow. Moscow is quite expensive, I guess, which is much easier to bridge that problem if you are, as yourself, if you're basically sort of Anglo-Russian, that you sort of, you not just speak two languages, but culturally you just know how people do stuff over here and how people do stuff over there.
Yeah, but I think we were able to bridge it not just by me being from St. Petersburg and being Russian, but also it's a very talented team. We're also building out the product team here in London and the two new locations which are opening, which are US and Singapore. So we'll have a global tech team.
That's very impressive. So in terms of not having done RegTech before, just for the sake of the listeners, give a little bit of background. If you're wondering why it took me 136 episodes to get around to something that's so important, the answer is I get assailed all the time with people wanting to be on the show, and not unsurprisingly, many RegTechs have reached out to me. But in terms of me replying and saying, yeah, that sounds cool, you know, what's your take on it? Too many, if I caricature only slightly, say, oh, computers and AI are going to read all the regulations and it's going to be made really easy. Maybe not. But in terms of clause match, Nigel Verdon himself, who's been on the show twice and somebody I immensely respect, mentioned you guys to me quite some time ago, actually. So it's taken some time to getting around to having you guys on the show. But clearly you go back quite a long way, and Nigel's imprimatur carries a lot of weight. But I think you founded in 2012, didn't you? What was your journey from St. Petersburg to sort of 2012? And why did you wake up one morning and think, oh, today I'm going to form clause match, that'll make a change?
Yeah, so it's a funny story, actually. So I moved to the UK in 2000. I went to school then, and I was coding at the time as a hobby. So I thought I would go into computer science and I'll become a computer scientist and continue my passion. But back then, that's when the dot-com bubble happened. And, you know, my parents jokingly said, well, you should go and get a real job rather than, you know, and real education rather than to do this nonsense. So I actually went and did a law degree in the UK and then a master's law degree in France, and then came back to London, joined by chance, actually, a Russian gas company, Gazprom, which was developing operations in Europe, in London. And I was there legal and compliance person working there for 5 years. But I kept my technology interest for all that time, obviously. So I actually worked on implementing document management solutions at Gazprom, and then later on joined Morgan Stanley, their commodities and derivatives unit. I was negotiating derivatives and commodities contracts, but also I worked on the technology committee looking at vendors for improving documentation for legal and compliance. And actually, that's when I saw the big problems in how we do things today. You know, back in the time, so just after 2009, we had new regulations coming out. So it was Dodd-Frank, it was MiFID I. And the implementation touched everything that we did within our department. So the regulators wanted to see how those new regulations, how new market events would affect the bank. And we had to go back to all of the documents which we negotiated, agreed, and created in the last 20 years. And the thing is, it's not actually possible to review those documents in time to find the relevant information with them. So to me, it was crazy that we're still creating documents in a way, you know, of Word documents, emails, tracking everything that happens to them in some sort of spreadsheets scattered across the organization. And knowing that things like Google Docs, things like real-time access to information was already available for the end users. So my idea was to create a platform which would allow to get access to that content which is created within the organization, which is highly critical, whether it's compliance, documentation, or legal documentation.
Yes, it's interesting. We'll come back to the clause match later, but clearly you had the two circles on the Venn diagram of understanding tech, should we use the word tech or coding, whatever you want to call it, but also understanding the legal and therefore the overlap along with your experience of documentation makes sense. It's the three of them. I know myself, having written non-legal, but having written almost 200,000 words in 2 years, and in terms of the bibliography, almost 300 bibliography, one of the things that's problematic in the modern world is that there is all this information, but we can be using very old-fashioned tools to manage it, and it gets quite an overload. So I started off very naively with a Word document, but once it got to about 30 pages or something, I mean, it was just a complete nightmare. In the end, and a tip for anybody who has to do sort of research or writing is to check out Scrivener. It's got a learning curve like everything else, but in Scrivener, it actually enables you to keep your research. It's got a tree stuff. Your book is split into chapters and sections and trees, so you just navigate around it all and manage that information. And without that, frankly, I would not have been able to do what I do. So I'm quite comfortable with the idea that we need the next generation tools. And we'll come on to those a little bit in the end. But taking the wider field of RegTech, and just before we get that, as I say, I joined the city and I started working before all this stuff existed. I mean, my fixed interest department managed $2 billion, which is a lot of money in those days. And there wasn't one regulation and one rule. You know, going back to cultural stuff, I did the right thing because that's what you did at Kleinwort Benson. And so to me, this massive volume is completely mad. So to the day I die, age 99, when I'm run over by a big red bus, I'll still think it's mad. For somebody like you who was sort of born when it was already sort of started and you start working when it's already started, is it something that you see more as, shall we say, I don't know, just an act of God? It's just like the weather. It just happens to be there and you have to deal with it. It's like today is finally a sunny weekend in London, which is fantastic, but it's been raining most of the summer. It doesn't matter whether you think rain is good or bad. It's just you've got to take an umbrella and wrap up warm if it's been too cold. It's just an act of God to people of your generation, as well as a great commercial opportunity, of course.
I think it's the complexity of the world grows, and the complexity of the world with new technology and new concepts, new discoveries, that complexity grows, and the interconnections between people, organizations, between governments, they become more complex. And it's clear that bad actors will always exist, and regulation will exist and grow to address, I guess, new phenomenons in society in order to address bad actors.
Yes, yes. So anyway, let's not get too sidetracked on the whole sort of philosophy of the regulation. I think that is the reason why new regulations are put in place. The problem that I see is the Goldilocks one. Your porridge can be too cold, i.e. they can be unregulated and people do naughty stuff, but your porridge can also be too hot. There can be so much regulation that you literally can't do anything. And I think I've mentioned before, when Kleinwort was taken over by the Dresdner Bank, the Dresdner being Germanic, had a million rules, which basically meant you couldn't do anything. The only way they got around it was that if you're a Vorstand main board member, if you've got one of them on the side, you can say, oh yeah, sure, forget the rules, you can do it. And in the same way, there used to be this phrase, supply-side reforms, which no one talks about anymore, which is goes back to the 80s. To me, Europe's below-trend growth, which it has had for some time, is because it is hyper-regulated. So you need two forces. It doesn't want to be too cold, it doesn't want to be too hot. There's plenty of forces. The expansion of the bureaucracy, which Sir Paul Tucker had spoken about when he was on the podcast, delegation by politicians, they can't be bothered to do stuff for themselves. But there is no force pulling it back. So, you know, taking MiFID II as clearly an archetypal example, because everybody mentions it. The problem of bad actors, as you say, it always exists, but is it actually helped by having almost 2 million paragraphs in a document, or babies in cots in a maternity hospital? Every year you walk into one of those, you say, OK, 30% of those are going to be compliance and regulation, and next year 40% of those, and next year until there's one person trying to make a profit and the rest of the economy. So I don't see, this is where I say it's just like the weather, I mean, in the end, what's the point complaining about it raining in London, it's raining. I don't see what force there is at this stage until Europe kind of collapses because it's just hyper-regulated, which says, OK, we need regulation, but we need good regulation, and good regulation is short, succinct and clear.
Yeah, well, I think the problem is there is too much regulation, and I think it's safe to say that not a single bank in the world is compliant with 100% of all the regulations which are applicable to them. They probably don't even know 100% of regulations which are applicable to them. And I think the other problem is that regulation is not agile today. Regulation is extremely cumbersome and slow to implement, and then cumbersome and slow to change as well. So, for example, if a piece of regulation doesn't work, it takes several years to reverse it, as we've just seen with Dodd-Frank, for example. So I think the problem there is that regulators are actually slow to move because they don't have access to tools and, I guess, ways of updating regulation in a faster way and communicating with the market in a faster way.
Yes, and coming from Russia, Russia tried state centralism for a few decades. It wasn't economically very successful there or in the USSR, and now the EU is trying it. I mean, this gets into a political thing ultimately, and if people are interested, they should check out the episode of Sir Paul Tucker if they haven't done so already. It is the withdrawal of the politicians from making big picture decisions. So I'll give you a prime example, which is in crowdfunding, equity crowdfunding in the UK, plenty of regulations around, but they're all minutiae. The regulator does not say, which I strongly believe they should, no B shares, for example. They could easily say, hey, equity crowdfunding platforms, only A shares, thank you very much. End of. That's one simple regulation. That will stop whole bunches of folks getting fucked over in deals. I mean, you know, one a while ago was a Camden Town brewery where the B shareholders really got screwed over. And, you know, if you've got a B share, you might as well sort of have a sign on your head that says, please don't screw me, I know you can. So one of the reasons I feel is that we've got this regulation by minutiae, as opposed to structural regulation, is because politicians have withdrawn from it. Going back to the 19th century, where did the company law company come from, which is the kind of company we have these days? Well, the answer is Gladstone created it in 1844. Gladstone was prime minister something like four times and Chancellor of Exchequer five times. You know, and in those days, when Britain was successful, you had the most senior person in the land. Looks at it, sets up a structure. In 1844, they created Companies House. He said, OK, for centuries, you had to be well connected to the monarch or to Parliament, pay a fortune to get a company. Now, I'm going to democratise that. Well, do Companies House cost £5, which was a hell of a lot in those times, but anyway, it costs £5 now and it costs £10, so the real cost has collapsed. And anybody can have a company. You know, so the big bull moves. Right, anyway, so putting that to one side, regulation is there, whether we like it or not, what we think will happen. I think it will all collapse well before 2050. It's unsustainable. And coming back to Russia and the USSR, I've forgotten who it was from Estonia was on the podcast, but I think one of the countries that's most impressed me by just simplifying things is Estonia. Okay, no taxation on retained profits in companies. Oh, that's nice and simple.
Yep.
On one sort of tax rate. Oh, that's nice and simple. It is possible, but there needs to be the political will. Anyway, so let's look at where we are today. What are the problems the banks, probably every other sector of the economy, are actually facing today? We've touched on the volume problem.
Yeah, but I think, you know, coupled with the volume problem is actually discovery of regulations. So if you take a top-tier bank, they are subject to between 150 to 600 regulators globally. And trying to just collect that information from regulators is extremely difficult. So you can imagine if you have 250 regulatory updates daily that you have to go through, there are teams of hundreds of people within banks actually looking at just collecting that information. And that's where I've seen already companies trying to do something, you know, collecting the regulation and trying to structure it and taxonomize it. I think the problem there is not the fact that we've got a lot of data scattered around. But I think the problem is much deeper, is the fact that every regulator issues their regulation in a different form, in a different format. For example, FCA will issue, when they provide an update to the regulation, and we worked with several regulators, so that's why we know how they do it, but FCA will issue an instrument document, which will show in a PDF document, which will show in black line, this is the section which we're amending, this is how we're amending it. And then they will amend their website, the handbook on the website, with the new provision. Now, consuming that information is extremely difficult. And that information is not in a digital form. You cannot kind of have that handbook or that regulatory text sitting somewhere in a structured form.
And by structured form in this context, you mean what, for example?
So let's say I've got a digital representation of the handbook, which is broken down into paragraphs, into sections, and also broken down into keywords, all taxonomized and tagged. Now, if you have that in a digital form, that means that it sits somewhere in a database. Each object has got its own place in the database. And you can query that database with a machine from another application. So suddenly, if you had that regulation sit in a database and you have an object of a regulation connected to some internal system saying this piece of regulation impacts this part within the bank. So, for example, I link it to a particular product, I link it to a particular person who is responsible, I link it to a particular policy and procedure and a process map.
I see. So you're taking a world which is historically regulators and everybody else produces a document.
Yeah.
And they hand over a document, you know, you're at HSBC and one morning a new document comes.
Yeah.
And then somebody goes, oh, I wonder who needs this document. But you're actually tying the information into the whole web in which it goes. I mean, just to take an example, I mentioned B-shares. So let's say in this case you've got structured stuff. Well, equity crowdfunders are fairly simple because they're not so large and they would know about it. But let's say every bank in Canary Wharf was involved in B-shares or something like that. And then tomorrow the FCA come out with something and say in 3 months B-shares are going to be forbidden. Then in your context, the structured stuff would mean that somehow, in some format, that comes via the interweb or something, into HSBC, into a computer, and that computer, quotes, knows, unquotes, the 437 people in HSBC that need to know about it.
Yeah, absolutely.
And send it to them. Is that what I'm is that what you're meaning?
Yes, exactly. It's practically taking the regulation and providing the immediate impact assessment of that regulation on the organization. And if every regulator did that, then you would be able to say, okay, I've got 10 anti-money laundering regulatory documents or in a structured form, 150 obligations from these regulatory documents, which are tagged as obligations, which are linked and connected directly into banks' internal systems, internal documentation, into everything. And then when there is an update, the update is not issued in a form of another PDF document. It's actually issued as a change to the original part of the regulation. And then that change triggers and alert everyone who is impacted.
I see. And picking the dimension up that I hadn't particularly spotted, going back to what you were saying, I think, about Gazprom, which is that the computer in HSBC, taking my simple example, would not just know which individuals in the organisation needed to know about changes in B-shares, but it would be also connected to the legal agreements and contracts they've got.
Yes, you can imagine that world where you've got legal agreements and contracts.
Which mention B-shares, you know.
Which mention
HSBC,
B-shares, exactly.
I've got a deal with a London FinTech podcast about B-shares or something. So the FCA sends something, 467 people need to know about it, they hear about it, but also somehow it goes to the document and the person responsible for that document says, oh, by the way, you've got to renegotiate with Mike this deal or something, or, you know.
Yeah, exactly. And we actually did a pilot with one of the banks where they had end user terms and conditions which are being updated in line with regulatory changes. So, for example, you know, regulations on financial promotion, on communication with clients and so on. Whenever that changes, you can imagine a large retail bank will have hundreds of different financial products which might be affected by a change in regulation. You need to change those terms and conditions for each product. And often you can miss things. And that's why, you know, we're seeing banks having to pay back a lot of money to retail clients whenever they haven't complied with a particular regulatory rule. And the pilot was, you pretty much can easily identify which parts of those client end-user agreements, client agreements, are affected by a particular piece of regulation, and you can connect them to each other. So you know exactly how a regulatory rule is implemented in the end-user agreements.
I see. So I'm seeing in my mind, I didn't know whether you've seen on YouTube, these kind of these things that people build with like a million dominoes or something, all standing up.
Yep.
And they sort of press it and go all around the room for half an hour, things falling and looking really pretty and all that kind of stuff. So what I'm seeing in my mind is that the world that you're talking about is that the computer and your systems and other people's systems and that kind of stuff set up these chain of dominoes so that the regulator sends something out and basically it pushes a domino and in each bank it goes down all the different lines to ensure that it's converted into action rather than, let's just go back 20 years, 20 years ago, there's a compliance department, and they go, oh, here's MiFID II. Oh, my God, who wants this in the organisation? Maybe we should read it. And they read it and think, oh, how does this impact? And going back to, I can understand how the banks don't do all the compliance. There is no way that, take HSBC, doesn't matter, it can be a mega bank or even a small bank, there's no way that any individual could possibly know all of the agreements of all the people all around the world from, as you point out, hundreds of regulators, the changes. So it becomes impossible.
Yeah, so for a human being, it's impossible, and we're still solving that problem with human manual labour.
Yes, right. OK, so that's the problem today, and I like this idea of the dominoes and connecting information and objects and people and departments and agreements and all that kind of stuff. So, as you say, the FCA will say, here's our new PDF. What are regulators around the world doing about this? Are any of them on the case here? Not least of which because they need it themselves. I mean, I spoke to somebody quite senior, quotes unquote, a few years ago, which obviously made nameless, in the then FSA, I think it was. And they were saying, did I know such and such a regulation? I said, oh, I don't know such and such a regulation. I can't keep track these days. And they said to me, and this is a person with sort of a couple of hundred people below them, no, nor can I. You know, so when people join this organisation, you get sent away for 3 months on it, but we can't remember all the regulation.
Yep.
That's the realpolitik, which is inside the regulators. How can they keep track of it? How can any human being keep track of it? So presumably they need some of this stuff themselves, but what are the regulators doing about making it much more assimilable to the reg tech world and to set off the process that you're talking about? Which is a really good one that's doing something.
Well, what we're seeing is there is a lot of talk now and actually pilots and initiatives by regulators to digitize regulation in a way that, from what I'm seeing, the digitization of regulation currently goes towards the efforts of digitization of regulation goes towards rule-based parts of regulation. So, for example, transaction reporting. The rule can be put in a code and then executed by machine on the bank side. But that's only probably 10% of regulatory rules. What I'm talking about is digitizing the entire regulation. So if a principle in a regulation changes, then everything that is affected by the change to the principle, so for example, treat your customers fairly and something else is added, then you can also understand the impact. So MAS, FCA, FINRA, FINRA is US, HKMA, they're all looking into it and they're all working on it. I think the problem is you can digitize regulation and convert a PDF document into code for a very small subset of rules. I think what we need is the actual tools for the regulators to create regulations in a structured form from the outset so they're not going through a 20-year-old process when they're updating regulation. An example is whenever there is a change to a paragraph in a regulation. It will go through hundreds of iterations of new Word documents, new versions of Word documents, through approvals, through the board approvals, through the consultation from the market, and it takes years to actually implement that change. Now imagine if the same paragraph is being changed in parallel by someone else, and it goes through the same process, and it might be that the two teams working on those two changes, they are not aware of what is happening with those changes.
Yes, so that's the sort of collaboration on a document, as it were, and going back to the book in simple cases. So I've got to output it from Scrivener into a Word document or send it off to the editor. And then, you know, they will be working on it and they'll send it back with changes and I'll send back my changes to their changes. And,
yep.
You know, that's a collaboration between two people, which is relatively straightforward, but actually quite time consuming. But as you say, on some mega thing, I mean, goodness knows how many human beings worked on MiFID II, the creation of all those paragraphs. It's a question of vast complexity. Okay, so the regulators are looking at this. No doubt they will take quite some time. So in this world, what are the institutions doing at the moment?
If I can go back to the point on regulators creating regulation in a different way, it's actually not a pipe dream. There are regulatory codes which are in a different industry, which are currently being digitized in this way. So to give you an example, we recently signed an agreement with a regulatory management company, which is managing energy regulation on behalf of the energy regulator in the UK. And they are currently digitizing and putting several regulatory codes on our platform to create and update those regulatory codes through the platform, publish that to the industry, also run real-time consultation process, and then being able to allow those energy companies which are subject to those regulatory codes to digest, to consume, and to interpret regulation through the machine executable code.
Oh, that's a really interesting angle, actually, because I think AFS is so mad, you can't take it and fix it there, but I think you can fix it somewhere else. And it's interesting about the energy. The other one I was thinking of that works quite well is airline regulation. I'm a big fan of National Geographic air crash investigates, and that process works well. You know, planes get safer over the time, and unlike in FS, planes can still take off the ground and fly elsewhere. And, you know, FS is just burdened. I don't know what percent of the average bank in Canary Wharf is involved with regulation, but I assume it goes up all the time.
Yep, all the time.
So institutions then, what are they doing? Are they just trying to do their best, struggling and using loads of people at the moment, as well as trialing reg tech stuff from you guys and other people?
Well, I think what we're seeing over the last 2 years, and that's why our business picked up as well, is pretty much every single top-tier bank in the world has got massive compliance projects in technology. So they're bringing in technology now to actually address regulatory change, to address their internal compliance management, their internal policy management, and also risk management. And what they're trying to do is tie in all of these aspects together. So digestion and understanding of the regulation, which is applicable to them. They're looking for technologies there, and we're seeing a lot of projects in that field. And then how internally the bank addresses regulatory rules. And I think it came in waves, and the adoption of RegTech is coming in waves. So while several years ago it was trade surveillance, and we saw a lot of companies doing trade surveillance, and that is being addressed and implemented right now. Anti-money laundering, KYC checks. It's actually not possible, not humanly possible, to do a proper anti-money laundering and KYC check on, for example, a complex company. So you need to have a machine doing that. So, you know, we've seen a lot of fines in that field, and that's why banks started implementing technology. And now we're seeing more and more contact-related fines, and these are a lot more complex to address, because how do you prove to the regulator that you've done everything possible for your people to conduct their business in the right way? So it's a lot more subjective, and that's why massive projects on internal policy management, training, digestion of the rules, and understanding how those rules are addressed, these are the projects that we're seeing more and more now.
Right. Okay, that's interesting. So in terms of the future, I was about to say 5 years, but at this rate, it'll probably take more than 5 years, 5 to 10 years from now. Where do you see RegTech going, and how is it going to change? As I say, I do get some like this, sort of idiots emailing me saying, oh, computer in the AI is going to read all the regulation and it's going to explain it all. And no, it won't. So what will actually happen in 5 or 10 years' time in your world of RegTech?
Well, I think when people say computers will read regulation and interpret it, it's an extremely complex world to actually get to that reality.
We're not going to sack all the lawyers yet, sadly.
Absolutely not. One difficulty there is that it's not enough just to have a structured text of regulation, and you need to have a structured data from the bank, and then understand how that data interoperates between each other. As I said, the domino effect. You kind of need that data set initially digested by people before you can have the machine automate that. And I think the reality is RegTech is helping today with some of the structured data sets which are out there already. So for example, AML, KYC checks, trade surveillance, this is more or less structured data which existed before, and you could run analytics on it. So transaction data is very easy to get. And if you have a clever algorithm, you can find patterns of bad behavior in transactions, in trades. With more subjective regulatory compliance, and rules and what regulators actually mean, we don't have enough data today to actually have AI automating that. But in time, it will come. That's why, you know, I talk a lot about digitized regulation and then connecting everything that is impacted by that regulation internally within the bank, because then the machine has more context.
Yes. So there's a lot in what you've been saying, and I can see that going forward, it does require a partnership. It's no good the bank's just getting better at dealing with sort of old-fashioned, here's a sort of 1,000-page PDF sorted out in your organisation. It needs to work on both sides, but ultimately it's in the regulators' interests, because they can't keep churning out stuff that's just impossible to implement along the organisation. And to Sir Paul Tucker's point, what is the unelected power, his book is called, what is the democratic position of these regulators? They can't keep carrying on for decades, issuing a ton of regulation every year and then fining people for not doing it. There will be pushback. There will be considerable pushback, and the political climate will occur somewhere. And meanwhile, in a globalised world, I'm a big fan of how well Singapore has done over the past decades and how well it is managed, there will be some who show the way. There will be some flagship projects and that it is done well. There will be some leading-edge regulators who are doing it properly and demonstrating to the others, well, actually, look, this is the way of doing it.
Yep.
So it's going to be interesting times, and by the sound of it, you're not going to get too bored over the next few years because you'll be quite busy. I don't think you're going to run out of business at all. Before we wrap up the show, I'd like to thank all of you listeners out there. Good luck to all of you in the regulatory world. At least you're going to be earning money for decades to come. And congratulations to all of you that don't have to deal with these headaches. I'd also like to thank my brand partner for the podcast, Smart Pension, who are fast, secure and free. Check out their UK workplace pensions at autoenrollment.co.uk. So, Evgeny, that's been sort of very interesting. I've learned a lot, and hopefully listeners have learned a lot. We haven't spoken very much about ClauseMatch. What is it that ClauseMatch specifically has in terms of products or services at the moment that bankers out there or fintechs out there that need to understand all this stuff can, as it were, give you a call, buy, trial, pilot, and all that kind of stuff?
Thank you, Mike, first of all. ClauseMatch is a platform which helps compliance professionals and risk professionals to keep up with internal policies and procedures which are addressing particular regulations. So at the core of it is a real-time document collaboration made in a structured form, and every change, comment, approval is tracked with a full audit trail behind each change. And then we have algorithms which help to connect, with use of AI, help to connect relevant content between documentation across the platform. So an example would be you would have your regulatory rules, regulatory obligations, policies and procedures and internal controls all in one single place, and then seeing the map of how they are interrelated between each other and how they relate to products, people, to departments, jurisdictions. So, and whenever there is a change in one of those components, then you see the alerts of how that change impacts and affects different parts of documentation and different parts of the bank.
And what kind of clients are you working with at the moment?
So it's actually funny. When I started the company, I said, we will have as our first client a global bank. And everyone told me, you're crazy. It's not possible to have as a small company. But our first client was Barclays.
Oh, fantastic.
And today we're working with many top-tier banks, but also fintech companies and asset managers. And recently we entered insurance as well.
So you've got lots of experience of product market fit. You've got a concept, clearly that's necessary. But you're also interacting with the market in terms of their practical stuff. And so I can see how you've grown quite well. Okay, so anybody who wants that kind of stuff can reach out to you guys. As I say, I've heard about you many years ago and been recommended by a blue chip fintech person. So ClauseMatch are someone that, if you're in this field, you definitely need to know about, whether you buy their stuff or don't, that's your decision, but you need to know what it is, I think. And any other shout-outs at the moment for the millions of listeners standing outside your window in terms of where you're going, what you need more of to be even more successful in the future, in case anybody out there has got it for you?
Yeah, so anyone in compliance, risk, conduct, anti-money laundering, from banks, insurance companies, asset managers, give me a shout-out. Also, we are running policy management workshops across the globe. We've just had two in New York and Singapore, and we'll be having them across Europe as well with one of the top experts in policy management and compliance in the world.
And your offices in New York and Singapore, are they sort of staffed up yet, or are they sort of being rolled out over the next few months, yeah?
They're being rolled out now, yeah.
So you're going to spend lots of time on an aeroplane going forwards, are you? Or you're going to sort of use Skype and your stuff?
I have been flying back and forth to both Singapore and New York, so it's been quite an interesting year for us.
Oh, have you flown from Singapore to New York the other way around?
No, it's a long way.
Excellent. Well, that's been very interesting. As I say, I've learned a lot. The world is mad in many ways, but in this way, it actually needs a lot of help in terms of coping with this all. As I say, you just can't keep finding banks and organisations and putting tons of regulation on them. But in terms of light of the tunnel, light at the end of the tunnel, I don't think it's quite light, but it's a tool to help cope with this. And I can see that the only sustainable future over the next few decades is if regulators get more of a grip on what they're putting out. And if they do it, as you say, in this quote, computerised, structured fashion to interact with organisations, otherwise it won't work. And you know, otherwise what will happen is some new Thatcher Reagan will appear in 20 or 25 years, or some dictator that says, I've sod all this regulation, we're just getting rid of a lot of it. And they will find different ways of handling the bad actor problem, because I think that all the evidence is, and let's take tax, we haven't talked about tax, we don't have time, but tax is a good example. If you say that everybody pays, I don't know, 30% income tax, or there is no income tax and there's just a sales tax and every shop has to gather it, there is no arbitrage. You know, rich people do not take advantage. Whereas, I think our tax code is longer than the Bible as well, or as long as 20 times the length of the Bible or something mad. When you've got tax codes like that, what happens is the likes of Apple and Starbucks and these people don't bother paying it. Rich people manage to avoid it, and poor people like podcasters or coffee shop owners have to pay it themselves. So there is a large extent to which massive regulation is the force keeping corporatism in place and advantages the rich and powerful as opposed to the poorer members of society. So there are, I can see, political ways forward going forwards, and it can be a very populist thing. Going back to ancient Assyria 4,000 years ago, which had everything that we have in business today, return on capital, markets, lending, transactions, all that kind of stuff. In those days, all the laws were chiseled into a tall steel like Hammurabi's, or there was one before that. And any citizen could go and read the laws. You can know exactly where you were. So anyway, back to Goldilocks' porridge. So anyway, in the meantime, you're helping move the thing forward and helping it making it more practical. It's many years, I'm glad to say, since I worked on stuff. But I did do a few gigs this century in banks around regulation. And I know that lots of sincere effort and lots of hard work goes in to trying to implement this. So anything that you can do to make it easier for them is actually good for society as a whole, because it makes the bank less likely to be fined or less likely to fall over when 99% of the bank are actually in compliance and one side is taking astronomical risks to pay for them all. So it's good to meet you, Evgeny, and I wish you every success in the future.
Thank you very much, Mike.
Thanks for listening. If you have consulting, advisory / non-exec, or media needs in the FS or fintech space, get in touch with me at mike@londonfintechpodcast.com.
We could sit in a bender all day, watching the firelight dance, watching the firelight dance. We could walk in the mountains before dawn, watching a happy moon ride, watching a happy moon ride. To come away from the city, the tarmac so dead and the people so sad. Come away from the city, but with the faces so grey, with the pain of the everyday. Like the mountains and the trees, can you see what I mean? Can you see what I mean? We fit in between the earth and the sky. Kiss the city goodbye, wave the city goodbye, wave the city goodbye, city goodbye. Watch the firelight dance with me, 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 watch the firelight.